Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Tuesday morning, February 10th, 26 degrees and under cloudy skies here in Old Town Park City, 29 degrees under cloudy skies in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Tuesday. We're looking at a chance of a couple of snow showers developing as we get towards the late morning and early afternoon hours. Then that'll likely become mixed as a little bit of rain and snow shower activity. Overall, the precipitation should be light, but we could pick up maybe a half an inch in some places here, especially up on the mountain with high temperatures climbing into the lower 40s. As we go into your forecast for tonight, look for a little better chance of snow developing, especially as we get after midnight tonight. Temperatures will dip down to near freezing in Park City. We'll see a rain-snow mix for the Heber Valley with those temperatures in the low 30s as well. Now, as we go into your Wednesday, look for a rain and snow mix for us in Park City, becoming all rain after during the afternoon hours. Meanwhile, for the Heber Valley, look for any snowflakes to quickly change over to rain by Wednesday morning, and off and on rain showers likely throughout the day on Wednesday as highs climb into the mid to upper 40s. We'll see that chance of rain and snow continuing into your Thursday. Park City, snow will become likely once again with those temperatures for highs back down into the low 40s, and we'll see a rain-snow mix on your Thursday for the Heber Valley with high temperatures into the mid-40s. Precipitation begins to taper off as we go into your Friday, and right now we've got a fairly dry weekend heading our way for the most part. Although as we get towards the end of the weekend, Sunday night into Monday, our next storm system looks to move in. That looks to be more of a snowmaker for us in Park City and a more of a rain-snow mix for us in the Heber Valley, and we could be looking at a little bit better chance of more significant accumulations with that system as we head towards the beginning of next week. But for us, this system here that's moving through right now, overall fairly light accumulations expected, around an inch or so for us potentially in the Park City area. Otherwise, in the Heber Valley, just a quick trace to a dusting at times, but majority of the event will be primarily a rain event as this is more of an atmospheric river tapping into some warmer temperatures. Let's look at your latest forecast with the Wasatch Back on ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
And with a look in the backcountry, on the phone we have Brooke from the Utah Avalanche Center. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie. Yeah, we're still sitting at a low avalanche danger this morning. That's because, like was said earlier, there's not going to be too much of an accumulation of the snow today, but we will be watching out for wind-drifted pockets near ridgeline. That new snow is going to be falling on top of very weak old snow that's been sitting out today. So mostly keeping an eye on wind-drifted snow and looking forward for some more snow later this week.
Okay, let's hope so. Thank you. Stay tuned. In just a minute, we'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Shane Scott, discussing his trip to the Olympics, as well as some of the ongoing legislative issues the county's watching for. From KUER, government reporter Hugo Ricard Bell with an update on this year's legislative session hitting that halfway mark. And from the Christian Center of Park City, Executive Director Steve Richardson, along with his wife Emily Richardson, one of the therapists at the Counseling and Wellness Center. Well, some Utah legislators hope to expand child care benefits for working parents. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports a Park City area nonprofit and government leaders advocated and worked on the policy.
Salt Lake County resident Melanie Call says she's seen firsthand the importance of affordable, accessible child care. Speaking to Utah legislators February 6th, Call recounted leaving her six-figure salary job to care for a newborn.
I'm actually the aftermath of not providing access to childcare. Like, we exit the workforce, and I was making over six figures, over $115,000 a year, and I could afford it, I just couldn't access it.
For other working women, affordability is just as important, if not more. House Bill 190 aims to address both issues by incentivizing businesses to provide childcare benefits or build childcare facilities on site. It expands the tax breaks Utah introduced for employers last year so that more provide their workers with childcare options. Park City Community Foundation Early Childhood Alliance Director Kristen Schultz says her organization, Park City Municipal, and Summit County staff are advocating for HB 190. The bill is sponsored by Cache County GOP Representative Jason Thompson and supported by the Policy Project, a Utah nonprofit focused on women and children's legislation.
And they thought that it fit really well within their portfolio of family affordability bills. They're pushing several bills this session, including HB 190. And so, honestly, I think this has been a really great example of collaboration between many groups who are interested in kind of making, you know, childcare affordable for Utahns.
According to data Thompson shared with the House Revenue and Taxation Committee, 74% of Utah parents with children under six say they need two incomes to afford childcare. Small business owner Lindsay White testified she's been unable to hire qualified candidates who turned down offers because they couldn't find care.
And when an employee tells me she's pregnant, I want her to feel excited, not terrified that she's about to lose her career.
HB 190 cleared the committee on a 7-4 vote after some debate. For example, Utah County Republican Representative Lisa Shepard worried about non-working women shouldering a bigger tax burden if employers get a tax cut. Salt Lake County Republican Representative Clinton Okerlund pointed out that women who are able to stay in the workforce will pay taxes on their income, somewhat balancing out the state's revenue. Elsewhere in the Policy Project's slate of family affordability bills, they're looking to expand the state child tax credit for families, not just employers. HB 190 now heads to the full House for consideration before a Utah Senate committee sees it. The 2026 legislative general session ends March 6th. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, later this week, Summit County Manager and Summit County Councilmember Tanya Hansen will be flying to Italy as part of a fact-finding mission. She and Scott joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So there is no council meeting with you and Tanya absent, but you'll be part of this IOC official observation program?
Yes. They're calling it the Observer Program, and I believe there are 91 total visitors from Utah that will be part of this observer program.
Okay, so you'll be traveling with Park City officials, or is there a different program for county officials?
I think county and city are going to be mostly together. We're both in part of what's called Wave 3, and they're focusing events we'll see. We'll get to be behind the scenes in a couple of places. Focused on city operations, snow removal, communications, transit, people moving, volunteers, those kinds of things that are behind the house, I guess.
Hmm. All right, so were you in Utah for the 2002 games? I mean, do you have a basic knowledge of how the games were operated back then?
I'd say yes to the first question and no to the second. I was in Utah. I was in St. George. So I did live in Utah when the games were announced, got to be at least part of the excitement around the games. I do have a couple of pins. I got one of the Jell-O pins. I was very excited about that. I was just a newly married young man back in 2001. But I was not behind the scenes. I was doing a job that had nothing to do with the Olympics. And so I'm very anxious, very excited to go and see these games here this year. I've never been to Italy before, so that's exciting for me as well.
Oh, sure. So I guess anything specific that you're interested in learning as part of this observer group?
Yes, I'm very excited to learn about. I think transportation and transit is such it's one of those really key initiatives that we have anyway. So seeing that in reference to the games will be very helpful for me. I'm very excited to learn more about communications. When you sit in a stadium and your phone doesn't work as well with all the traffic, how do they manage that? Are essential communications on their own networks? I'd like to know a lot about cell phones. I know 2034 we might be in a little bit more of a little technologically advanced area, but what does that look like today in 2034? I've also been told, and this may or not be exactly accurate, but that Cortina is a relatively small place where they may have visitors that come for the day, for an event, that maybe don't stay there. Maybe they stay in Venice or stay in Milan. And so are we going to be similar in that people could possibly travel to our area and not necessarily stay here? So are there ways that we can capture people in restaurants and make sure that we maximize a visitor experience where people are traveling to our community? How do we get them around as opposed to just those that may come and stay? Volunteers, I'd like to see how we have such a spirit of volunteerism in our community. In fact, I know a few members of our community that are actually over there now, including our own KPCW's own Frank. So I would like to, how do we engage those folks that live here in volunteerism? And then somehow Italy, maybe it's just because it's a really beautiful place in Europe, that they've been able to recruit volunteers even from our community to work there. So how do we do that? How do they engage them? I know I remember hearing about Paris a couple of years ago, and that every volunteer had the same colored shirt. And it seems so simple and such a small thing, but I know that was very helpful for those that had a question, needed to know how to get to a venue. So I think those small little decisions make a big difference in putting off a first-class games.
Yeah, those were Olive Green last year, or in 2002.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's see, will you be able to attend any of the competitions?
We do have some tickets to a luge event as well as a curling event. But we do have every day for 7 days in a row, we have, as part of that observers program, we have a confirmed space. I think it's about 3 to 4 hours in different operations. So those are all behind the scenes. So yes, I am excited to see some events, and I hope to pick up one or two in the evening when I have a spare moment. But every day we have something to see, whether it's city operations, snow removal, fan experience. I think there's one about sustainability that I'm very excited about. I think here in Utah, here in Summit County, we have our unique opportunity to really be a showpiece for the sustainability efforts that we make in reference to the 2034 Games. I think that's something that is on the radar for the Salt Lake City Organizing Committee, but it's so important to the IOC that we have a sustainable Olympics. So I think we can do some really exciting things with our staff and our community in that regard.
Yeah, and as we know, the Italian Olympics are really spread among large areas. Will you be able to kind of get to some of those bases, or are you pretty much centered in Milan or Cortina?
I think we are quite centered in Cortina. Mm. I have mentioned it to a couple people that we're flying in and out of Venice, and it sure would be a shame if the only thing in Venice I see is the airport. So I'm hoping I get to walk around a little bit, or maybe even take a day and spend that. But as I look at my schedule, and the schedule that Councilmember Hansen and I have, it's every day we have something in Cortina, and we have transportation to Cortina and as part of the program. So I think we'll spend the lion's share of our time there in that smaller community.
Okay. And so was this travel contemplated in last year, for the budget?
It was. We did plan on sending two people, and I believe that we'll do at least two individuals to the Olympics leading up to 2034. I think that is our plan generally. Of course, that's contingent upon council's decision, but we did talk about it as part of the budget process.
Yeah, I understand you. So with the council members, did they have to draw straws, or how did they figure out who go?
Well, it was kind of interesting because I think Councilmember Robinson wasn't able to go. Councilmember Armstrong had gone to Courcheval in 2023, and I think Councilmember Hart was talking about going. I think Councilmember Hansen. I think it landed on Tanya pretty easily, but there wasn't too much wrangling. And then I think Councilmember McKenna is just new and thinks there might be an opportunity to go next time. So
okay, let's move on to what's happening at the legislature. Maybe start with the bill that would say Summit County would have to pay property taxes to Morgan County on the 910 Ranch. And I guess I thought Greenbelt, well, maybe not tax-free, but certainly very low taxes. But if held by a nonprofit, there would be no property taxes paid. So why would we have to?
Yes, I guess the model is just using federal or even sometimes state lands. State lands will be in a county, and they will pay PILT taxes, or payment in lieu of taxes. I think the taxes we calculated, this property in the 910 was in Greenbelt. So the taxes we would pay every year to Morgan County under this bill would be just over $500. It does seem pretty insignificant, but obviously Morgan County has a certain feeling about this. It's a real tricky bill for us in several ways. One of those is, as we lobby together as part of the Utah Association of Counties, we have a county here that's running a bill, and a county, in my opinion, us, that is maybe the victim of the bill. So I don't think this is a good bill, whether it's for us or not. Morgan County has said, we've worked out our differences with Summit County. This is for the future. A lot of what I'm hearing is that they are concerned about rezoning in a county. That really doesn't make a lot of sense to me. We're not able to just buy property in another county and rezone it. That's not how local government works, and I would think that county officials in Morgan County would know that. So I'm pretty frustrated with this. I thought we were working together in maybe a little bit better way. We would have to apply for any zoning changes. We obviously certainly are not doing anything on the 910 that's not in conservation-minded, and those conservation easements have shown that. So we're working on an ILA still with Morgan County that would maybe memorialize a lot of these kinds of issues between the two of us. And we'll do that, of course, in a public meeting eventually. But I just don't think HB 445 is necessary.
Now, since Summit County may be paying these taxes to Morgan County, does that mean that they then patrol and enforce laws on the Morgan side of the ranch?
Well, we'd like to. The example I keep thinking about is if we find a poacher in on the 910 and we're trailing that person, and then we get to the Morgan County line, I would assume we don't want to stop and let that person go. We want to continue on with that enforcement action. So that's really important. I believe that our sheriffs from both sides have also had a conversation about that and have agreed to work together in a mutual aid manner. So I think that will work itself out as well. But we'll probably also memorialize that kind of a relationship in the ILA that we propose with Morgan County.
All right. And in addition, are we covering the road maintenance, or would they maintain the road to East Canyon?
The part in Summit County, we certainly are. That might be a debatable issue if they would like. If I think maybe their concern is valid that this acquisition might bring a lot more traffic to their community. I think we could address that if that were the case. I think almost everyone would access the 910 from the Summit County side. I don't think it's even feasible that the other side would be utilized that much. If it's a Class B road, we're certainly if they receive funding for the maintenance of that road, we certainly wouldn't just take over maintenance of a road that they receive funding for. So there's a lot to it. There's a lot of aspects of that we probably still need to discuss. But I can say that the Summit County Council is very motivated to make our relationship with Morgan County better generally, and specifically on the 910. We just want to be work together as partners.
Yeah, so is it awkward? I mean, because again, we share, Morgan and Summit share a House representative, Tiara Oxy, and whose side is she coming down on?
I don't know. I don't know if it needs to be a side issue. I think she can hopefully support both of us. I would say these same things to her, that we are working well with Morgan County. We're working together. We're trying to. There's a lot of other ways that we would work with Morgan County. I remember one when I first got here 3 years ago. Individuals were talking about the Weber River and how the people would go and float the river, and they would leave their garbage, and they would get in on the Summit County side and exit on the Morgan County side. So there was like an effort to work together on that, and there was a road over in Croydon that we were working together with on the maintenance of. So there's lots of ways. There's maybe a little bit of a boundary dispute along our border between the recorder's offices, but we're working together with them very well on all those issues, and we hope we can just continue to be professional and work it out.
Yeah. So any idea why a Salt Lake County representative is running the bill?
No, except it just gives me flashbacks from the districting bill, which was run by Rips of Tusher out of South Jordan. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure how those legislators are roped into bills. It doesn't seem like. I think this strong is actually out of Riverton, if I understand that. And I'm so sure that is a little confusing to me.
All right. Moving on to the county classification amendments. Currently, Summit County, a third-class county. What could change here?
Well, as is, I don't think anything. I think you have to meet a two-fold criteria to change class. One is revenue and one is population. I believe we do not meet the population threshold. So I believe that we would stay a third-class county, which is absolutely what we are advocating for. We have a lot of taxes and other abilities that were tied us to third class county ship, and so we're trying to make sure that stays. We don't want to go change a bunch of code or try to get for grandfathered status for certain things. So I believe right now we are good with that bill.
Okay, real quick, what about the Ivory and GARF applications? We had heard from Community Development Director Peter Barnes about this last week. Anything new that you know?
No, I think what I heard last from Ivory myself was they're taking a two-track plan. They were going through the preliminary municipality process. That process is initiated through the Lieutenant Governor's office. Eventually, as part of that process, Summit County would be able to weigh in on a feasibility study. So we would be able to say, yes, well, we can't provide law enforcement services or we can, and some, roads and all those kinds of things that a city is going to need. So we would go through that process with them. And, but at the same time, I believe Peter Barnes probably spoke about their application that he has received for, I believe it's over 3,000 homes on 400 acres, and we don't have a zone that would accommodate that. So there's going to be a rezone, not only a rezone application, but an application for a new zone for us to accommodate that. So that's happening, and we'll see which one of those tracks or none of the above as we move forward.
Yeah, anything else you got your eyes on?
The only other thing I have today is that we have a solid waste master planning effort that is underway, and we have an open house tonight from 6 to 7:30 at the Mountain Regional Water Building. They have a new building over there in the Silver Summit area. We encourage anybody that is interested in our master planning efforts around solid waste and recycling to come to that open house from 6 to 7:30 tonight.
Okay, well, have a great time. We'll talk to you when you get back.
Thanks, yes. We'll talk about Italy when we get back. Thank you.
Okay, that's Summit County Manager Shane Scott. It's day 22 of the 45-day legislative session, just hitting the halfway mark on the phone with a look at what's happened so far and what's still to come in this year's state legislative session is KUR reporter Hugo Ricard-Bell. Good morning, Hugo.
Hey, Leslie. How you doing?
Doing great. So start by just giving us a recap of last week's actions.
Well, Leslie, you know, since we last talked, the courts are still up there and top of mind. There's still a lot going on in that space. I mean, the Supreme Court expansion has been signed, sealed, and delivered, and a bill that would create a constitutional court is also making its way through the session. And this would create a court that focuses on challenges to constitutional law. A good example of this recently would have been, say, the redistricting drama. Some public safety bills last week were beginning to make their way through the session. One would give DCFS what's called an investigative warrant, and another looks to reform juvenile justice systems. And I'll go into detail on those shortly with you. But yeah, look, it's been funny. We're already 4 weeks in at the halfway point, like you said. And, you know, from my perspective, it feels like it's been a bit of a blur, but House Majority Whip Candace Peruzzi, she actually stood up in session the other day and told lawmakers that they are moving at a snail's pace and to speak to bill sponsors in their own time so debates don't go on for so long. So that was a little bit of a wake-up moment, I think, for everyone.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I've read more than 800 bills have been filed, and that just seems like way too many to consider in the, you know, 45 days. Is it just creating chaos?
It seems to be. It's busy. I'll put it that way. Like, I've been watching a lot of the floor sessions, and they are trying to sort of motor through bills, and it feels like committees are being very, very thorough because of just the amount of bills they've got to get through. So anything that does go to the floor is one that's up for ready for proper debate. But, you know, this has been a theme that Governor Cox, I mean, even in his last speech at this State of the State, really hammered on, just please stop writing so many bills. But it doesn't seem like that's going to be this year. But, yeah, like I said, we'll see. We're halfway through.
All right. Well, let's start with House Bill 184. Again, this is the land use bill that's very concerning to Summit County officials. Where do things stand here?
You know, this bill is the one that cut some red tape around construction of starter homes on smaller lots. And basically, it would allow people to request to build a starter home on lots of land they typically wouldn't be allowed to in their city. It's copped some controversy because for a few different reasons, but one that stood out to me was basically this whole timeline thing. So if the city doesn't respond to a request in 30 days, people are allowed to just accept that it was a thumbs up to go ahead with construction. And I was really worried that, you know, because we spoke about this bill last time I was on 2 weeks ago, and I was really worried that there would be nothing really to give you an update on because it hadn't seen committee. And it wasn't until last night that lawmakers debated the bill, and it was seen in the House Economic Development and Work Services Committee, and After about an hour and a half, it's been held, which means it basically sits in limbo and will be closer examined by committee members. They could not agree on some crucial parts of the bill, namely things like the timeline, what it would look like for certain cities, which districts and counties would be allowed to use this law. And so it's still struggling to get the vote to move forward. I guess we're just going to have to wait to see if it gets some traction in the second half of this session. But it still lays stagnant in the committee hearings.
Okay, so it has to get through committee before it can come to the full floor?
Yes, that's my understanding. Mm-hmm. And when they said, when they announced that they were going to hold the bill and took a vote on that, the lawmakers did sort of speak to the fact that they wanted to address this one-on-one and work on this bill more before presenting it again.
Okay. And does the state legislature have similar rules in terms of requiring a 24-hour notice of something they're going to talk about, you know, like municipalities and counties do?
That's a question I've never really considered. I mean, when it comes to covering the legislature, we do know what bills are going to be hitting the committee a long way out. So, I don't have a definitive answer to that for you.
I'm just curious, you know, or is this something that's going to kind of just jump, you know, surprise us? Because that certainly has happened before, you know, that things come up that we don't know about and can't be there to, you know, for people to make comment on. So, we'll look into that. Let's move on to Senate Bill 124. This is sponsored by Senator Luz Escamilla, and it updates Utah's child welfare laws. Tell us about this.
This one was fascinating to watch in committee, Leslie. This really had a push and pull from both sides. It basically, what this bill effectively does is it creates what's called an investigative warrant. Basically, the Division of Child and Family Services are going to be allowed to file for an investigative warrant based on suspicion of child abuse. And if they get this investigative warrant, which would be applied, which would be filed through the juvenile justice courts, it basically means families can't hide their children from them when they show up and knock on the door, which happens quite a lot, according to Escamilla, and it'll basically force them to open the door and let the Division of Child and Family Services into their home so they can look around and they can eyeball the child that they believe is getting abused. And some of the bigger cases and tougher cases that have been pointed to that have inspired this bill are things like the cases of Gavin Peterson from Weaver County. Now, what happened there was he was isolated for a year, he was pulled out of school, and he subsequently died of starvation at the hands of his family. Now, DCF knew about this case. He had been on their radar, but they weren't able to enter the home. Similar cases that you can think of, really famous ones like the Frankie family. These sort of cases really disturbed Senator Escamilla, and she's sort of pointed to them as being a real motivator as to writing this bill, because she said there's been a evolution of you know, child abuse has changed. It's now, you know, tactics like isolation and stuff like that are getting used, at least in her opinion.
Yeah.
Now, those against the bill, Leslie, they think it's going to infringe on parental rights. And many who spoke out against this told stories of DCFS wrongly accusing them of child abuse and then being proven, right in those cases. So it's one of those bills that it has strong arguments on either side, and that was very definitely demonstrated in committee. But it seems to be making its way onto the House floor pretty comfortably. And I think Senator Escamilla is quite confident with it moving forward.
Okay, interesting, because again, there are due process and privacy rights, right? I mean, guaranteed by the Constitution.
Yeah, especially in Utah. And Utah holds those values very strongly, you know. It also, like, the other thing, Leslie, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but it comes at a really interesting time because a legislative audit has just been released of DCFS. And it was, I think it got released like an hour or two after the committee hearing on this bill where they debated it. And it showed a lot of incompetencies when it came to the leadership in DCFS. And so some people were pretty skeptical as to whether giving them another tool was the right move. But again, bill sponsor, Senate Minority Leader Luz Escamilla, said the audit was incredibly disappointing, but they still need the right tools in the shed to be able to operate effectively. So that's where it stands at the moment.
Okay, and then moving on, House Bill 48. This makes a set of changes to the criminal justice, juvenile justice law in Utah. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so this one again got quite a lot of push and pull from both sides, and it's these sort of bills do typically sort of get every year. There's something like this that comes forward, but they might not get the attention just because it's in a part of the world that a lot of people don't get to see, and that is the world of juvenile justice. But I think with all the focus on the courts, it's sort of made its way to the top of mind for some people. Long story short, this bill looks to reform a lot of areas of the juvenile justice system. Namely, they want to collect data on recidivism rates and change the way they collect that data. Basically, they want to look into whether or not kids continue to commit crimes after entering or leaving the juvenile justice system. This part of the bill hasn't really been challenged, Leslie, but people are concerned. But where people are concerned, sorry. Is the bit of the bill that would loosen regulations around when a juvenile can be sent to adult prison. Now, Representative Carrie-Anne Lisenby wants to give judges an opportunity to send, say, a 17-year-old who commits the crime of aggravated murder to adult prison if they turned 18 before sentencing. It's very specific. It's very... how would I say, it affects a very small population. Aggravated murder is a very rare case in juvenile justice, but there's a lot of pushback from a lot of different angles on this. Mainly there's that fear of this young person being victimized and brutalized by older inmates. Now, aggravated murder is a really tough crime to prosecute because it's heinous. These cases are ones that are, they're brutal. They're often involving gang activity, that sort of stuff, and so it's very easy, I guess, for the everyday person to assume the worst punishment possible. But that's not how the juvenile justice system works in Utah and in America. It's very focused on rehabilitation. These cases get long sentences, okay? That it is inevitable that when a child does commit a case like aggravated murder, they will eventually end up in adult prison. But there is an effort in Utah at the moment to make sure that they see the justice from the juvenile side first and then get moved there when appropriate. And defense attorneys and child advocates, they do not want to see this changed because they're worried that if you do just send a 17 or 18-year-old straight into the adult system, well, they're going to be brutalized, they're going to be recruited by gangs, and that opportunity for rehabilitation just gets completely sort of lost at the wayside.
Okay, finally, give us an update on the efforts to save the Great Salt Lake.
I'm glad you asked, because we just did a whole State Street episode on this, and the question we were asking, Leslie, was, it's been 4 years since the Year of Water in 2022. What progress have we made? Essentially, in our deep dive, and I'll give you some hints, but you really should go and listen to the podcast episode wherever you get your podcasts for State Street. And essentially, the big take-home message is this is not going to be fixed in a couple of years by a few bills. It's going to take a concerted effort from all stakeholders over decades. Something that I found really interesting, though, is I spoke to a scientist, Bonnie Baxter, from Westminster University. And she told me that the 2022-23 snow season, I'm sure you remember that, Leslie, it would have been wonderful in Park City, I can only imagine, was one of the worst things to happen to the Great Salt Lake, because I think a lot of people took the foot off the gas and thought that it was solved. But, you know, we're entering those historic lows, she said, that we saw 4 years ago when some of this Great Salt Lake legislation was written. So it's not all doom and gloom. A lot of stakeholders do believe that, you know, with time, we will achieve our goals. But some of the scientists, like Bonnie Baxter, are not so confident, Leslie. But it's all in the State Street episode. You really should go have a listen.
Okay. Hey, Hugo, thanks for your time this morning.
Anytime, Leslie. Talk to you next time.
That's KUR reporter Hugo Ricard-Bell with an update on this year's legislative session. The studio now with an update from the Christian Center of Park City. I have the executive director, Steve Richardson, along with his wife, Emily Richardson, who serves as one of the Counseling and Wellness Center therapists. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
So, Steve, what's keeping you busy at the center these days?
A little bit of everything. Obviously, still dealing with food insecurity, still dealing with people who are trying to get healthy and get wealthy and get wise, however you see it, and trying to support them as best we can with food insecurity, with rent assistance, with mental health counseling, and any kind of hope as we gear up for our Easter baskets. And that's one of the funnest, most fun times of the year is seeing all those Easter baskets, giving out 1,500 Easter baskets to the kids in need, all made by our community.
Okay, so that program underway?
It is. It is. It's kicking off now.
Yeah, so what do you ask people to do? Just financial contributions or
so
actually bring some chocolate?
The best way is actually to buy some chocolate, to buy a little basket, to buy a toy. We have ideas of how to make the Easter basket right on our website, and then get your friends together and make 20, 30 Easter baskets and bring it to the Christian Center before Holy Week.
Okay. Let's see. You recently hired a new director of the Counseling and Wellness Center, Susan Hammer, unable to join us this morning, but mm-hmm. she leads a team of how many therapists?
Right now we have 7 therapists.
Okay, and Emily, of course, one of them. Tell us a little about yourself, Emily.
Hi. Yes. So we came here about 15 months ago, and I've been a counselor for about 13 years, and I'm just excited to be a part of this ministry. The Counseling Center is doing some really good things.
Okay, and of course, it's February, the month of love for many. This is not a good time, right? I mean, people either going through a tough time with their partner, may not have a partner, and mm-hmm. these manufactured holidays never make it great for everyone. Are you dealing with some of that, or?
Yeah, we sure are. I mean, you're right. It is a hard time for some people. We're dealing with some anxiety, some depression, just some people going through just a hard time. But you know, I mean, even those that do have a relationship, sometimes it's still a hard time, right? We're going through some serious times here. And, you know, if we're seeing a lot of people that are having a hard time connecting with their significant other, and maybe they're saying, you know what, I say one thing, but they hear another thing, or they read relationship books and they try and, you know, those techniques inside the books. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But all in all, you know, we've had some people say, hey, you know, our relationship, it's fine. It's not a big deal. It could be better, but it's okay. But, you know, relationships don't get better on their own. So sometimes it's just one of those hard things where it's better if we see a relationship, if you see your relationship getting worse, then, or it's not getting any better, you know, it's time to get counseling before it gets even worse and want to catch that, you know, and get some help.
While they're still talking to one another.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So again, how does the Counseling Center help with that?
You come in and just sit down with a counselor and talk about just whatever's on your mind, I guess. And it's all based on the client and what they need to talk about and work through.
Yeah, so as a married couple, as you might know, I was trained in marriage and family therapy back in 2006, so I've been doing this for 20 years. And anytime you sit down as a counselor or as a couple with a counselor, the goal is not to counsel one or the other, it's to counsel the space in between the two individuals. So any relationship counseling is not about finding fault in one person or the other, it's finding a way to communicate better, to connect better, to grow together better. So we're always counseling the space in between the two people. That's what marriage counseling is different than regular individual counseling.
Okay, so I mean, the two are always together?
Yes, the best type of marriage counseling is always with both people at the same time. It's a system. And so if we're just working on one part of the system, the other system stays in what's called homeostasis. So it doesn't tend to change unless you're able to change both parts of the system at the same time. A marriage is two individuals working together to try to figure out how to do this life better. And we want to help each individual marriage do better.
Yeah. So what's the, I mean, does it come to the point where it's just like, you know what, this isn't going to work and it's time to split?
Unfortunately, yes. There are people who are not able to work together. They're not able to make it. Interestingly enough, in the University of Utah, they did a study back in 2005 on the cost of divorce, the cost of breaking up relationships that actually had a cost to the community, had not just a cost to individuals, but it was quite extensive. And it was done right here in Utah, this study. And so there are difficulties, and a lot of people stay together for the kids, and they stay together for the money, and they stay together for the house, and we're not wanting people to stay together for that. We're wanting people to stay together if they believe their marriage can be better than right now. I would never want people to stay in a bad marriage. It's either you make the marriage better, or you say it's just not going to work.
Yeah. Now, in years past, the Christian Center has offered training from the Gottman Institute, right? Mm-hmm. Again, another couple like yourself that does a lot of marriage and therapy counseling. Do you plan to bring any of those trainings back?
We do plan to bring some of the trainings back. So one fun thing is because I did my counseling training first. Emily was so inspired. She ended up doing it right after mine. So I did it in Texas. She did it in Colorado. We've been traveling around the world for years, training about 20,000 couples and trying to improve marriages, whether it's in seminars, retreats, talks. We've done this so often. In fact, from Hawaii to Europe to Alaska to Florida and everywhere in between. And we want to make sure we're able to provide that same sense of support and the same sense of connection in Park City. So you'll be hearing more about those soon.
Awesome. Okay. Well, talk to me a little bit about what you call the magic 5 hours. What is this and how do you use it?
So the Gottman Institute is the one that did the magic 5 hours. And so you mentioned Gottman. That was one of his things. It's one of our favorite things to just teach people because it's so simple and so easy to say, if I could just do this five things that are total 5 hours every week, it's maybe not going to make my relationship perfect, but it's definitely going to make my relationship better. And it starts with 2 minutes a day, 5 days a week, saying goodbye. Now, it seems small, 2 minutes saying goodbye, but if you think about how long it actually takes most of us to say goodbye, it might be 2 seconds, it might be 10 seconds. What it means is you do it purposely. You purposely say, I want to spend 2 minutes, maybe having a cup of coffee, maybe having a hug, and just saying goodbye meaningfully to the other person. And then second, Emily?
Yeah.
So well, I was going to say that's going to piss my husband off, waking him up at 6 in the morning to say goodbye. But okay.
And I've done it with text with some couples. So in the military, they used to happen all the time. One would leave before the other. And so I would say, well, then say goodbye by text. You know, wait till the person wakes up, have a phone call, have a text, send an email, send an emoji, something that is meaningful to say, hey, have a great day.
Okay. Yeah. And Emily?
Yeah.
Second.
Yeah. So the second one is when you come home, spending some time saying hello and how was your day? So whether that can be, you know, sitting down, for dinner or, you know, having whatever time is available to you to sit down and make that connection.
And they recommend just 20 minutes a day. It doesn't need to be 3 hours to connect. Just a 20-minute conversation every single day is good enough. It's fascinating.
Okay. What else?
The third one is 5 minutes for appreciation and affirmation. So 5 minutes total between telling my spouse how wonderful they are and thanking them for what they do. That it's that attitude of positivity. So if I just spend 5 minutes, it doesn't have to be 5 minutes all at once. That can be a little annoying and hard to think of. But 5 minutes total throughout the day of just reminding the loved one, a spouse, a kid, a boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever it might be, how special and how thankful you are to have them in your life.
Yeah, because sometimes we feel like we can't do anything right.
Right, right. We all need that positivity.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also physical touch. So, and I remember how many minutes that was for that one.
As long as I can get.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, whatever physical touch means to you, you know, hand-holding or hugging or whatever that would look
yeah.
like.
Yeah, so they yeah. say, Gottman also says 5 minutes for that. And what he says is there's some psychological, physiological changes, hormonal changes, chemical changes that happen when two people actually have skin-on-skin contact. So he says anything skin-on-skin. It can be the really good kind of skin-on-skin that we love to celebrate on Valentine's Day, or it can just be a handhold or a hand on the shoulder, whatever helps.
Yeah.
And then the final one he recommends is a two-hour date every single week. Not every day, once a week, just spending 2 hours together. Now, for people that are a little bit older and the kids are out of school, that's pretty easy to spend 2 hours together and hopefully make that right. For people that have younger kids, it might be really hard to find a babysitter. So I tell young couples to, you know, get your kids in trouble with something once a week, you know, do some trumped up charges and send them to bed early. And just open a bottle of wine, or just have a conversation, maybe take a walk around the backyard or whatever it might be, just to connect with your spouse, to spend 2 hours that they know it's just about them.
Yeah. Well, as two people, again, who have the background and the knowledge, I mean, is this something you guys do?
We do. We try to practice every single week. The weekly date is tough. Mm-hmm. You know, with as busy a lives as we get it, we know it's tough, and all it's tough for everybody. But we've seen it work for us just to try to be purposeful, just to try to remember to make that other person feel valuable. In so many of our retreats, we've seen the simple fact that one person or the other, sometimes both, just don't feel as valuable as the other person thinks they are. So it's about, what can I do every single day to make my loved one feel valuable to me?
Okay. And if somebody is interested in marriage counseling, I mean, give me an idea. Is it something that you're going to do for the next year? Or is it something that can be kind of fixed in a couple of months? Or
even one session. I've had a couple come in for what I call a marriage tune-up. It's not quite on the edge of divorce. They're not quite that bad, but they are struggling. And one session makes a huge difference. At the end, they say, you know what? I check on them a year later, and they're still doing well. So it could be one session, it could be five sessions, it could be 10 sessions, hopefully not much beyond that, because it's not about individual, it's just about connection. Mm-hmm. And we can do connection pretty quickly if you give us a chance.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah, it's just trying to develop those skills in terms of listening or communication, and however long that takes, that's what we try to do.
Yeah, sometimes just saying put down the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Just pay attention to me.
Okay,
yeah.
Anything else you want to add?
Well, we thank you very much. We're excited. Don't forget about the Easter baskets, everybody. Check out the Christian Center website, and let's show the kids around this community that we really love them.
Okay, Steve and Emily Richardson, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, a major home builder could bring thousands of units to Summit County's Browns Canyon. KPCW's Connor Thomas explains why Ivory Homes has filed applications with both the county and the state to increase density.
In January, Ivory Homes filed two parallel development applications on behalf of landowners in Browns Canyon. One was a rezone request with Summit County seeking a new zoning category, and the other petitioned the state of Utah to create a new town. Ivory Development President Chris Gambroulis says the company would prefer the rezone and not to be in charge of its own town.
But we filed a preliminary municipality application as a contingency. And, you know, we've had prior experience, and we have real concerns about whether a project of this size can be processed in a timely and predictable way.
The rezone request, which KPCW obtained through a public records request, is larger in size and scope than the development described in Ivory's incorporation petition. The rezone covers 600 acres, 400 of which would be developed with about 2,300 to 3,000 units of housing. Gamfrulis likened the look and feel of the neighborhood, dubbed Lost Creek, to another Ivory project, Park City Heights. The area is about 3 miles up Browns Canyon Road from State Route 248 and centered around the large white barn of Goldstone Ranch. The land to be developed is owned by LLCs associated with the Garf and Rogers families. Maps are available at kpcw.org. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.